Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents An Essay for Ezra, Racial Terror in America, by Grant Fered, narrated by Earl Sewell. It is necessary to live in terms of terror. Alexander Kojève. Introduction to the Reading of Hegel. Lectures on the Phenomenology of Spirit. Because. For man to be redeemed from revenge, that is, for me to bridge to the highest hope and a rainbow after long storms. Friedrich Nietzsche. Thus spake Zarathustra. Chapter 1, November 2016. Wednesday morning, November 9th, 2016, assumed its usual routine. Except, it was nothing like a normal morning in our household. Nothing like it at all. Following the pattern of mornings, my wife, Jane, got up around 6 a.m. with our son Ezra, who was then 8 years old. As is their practice, mother and son sat down to breakfast. I write late. Jane prefers to work in the morning, so I normally rise about an hour later. For her part, Jane is generally in bed by 10 p.m. That part of our domestic routine was business as usual. What was not normal was everything that happened after Jane had her first cappuccino and Ezra picked his way through an assortment of offerings. For Ezra, breakfast could be anything from a randomly chosen cereal to freshly prepared mac and cheese. Mac and cheese might be his first meal on a good day. Ever since Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president, Ezra has listened carefully to Trump's pronouncements. It is a habit, I am glad to say, that he retains to this day. At home, whether we are watching television news, almost always of the cable variety, he is scrolling through sites on his iPad, or he and I, or he and Jane, are listening to National Public Radio in the car on our way to or from school. Ezra pays unusual attention to what Trump has to say. In the build-up to the 2016 election, Nip, my nickname for Ezra, was especially tuned into Trump's pronouncements as they concerned race, or, more precisely, racism and gender. Trump hates women, Ezra said after several stories broke about Trump's behavior in relation to women who had worked with him in business, been contestants in his beauty pageants, or been involved in his TV shows. Ezra's distaste for Trump's misogyny intensified as the Access Hollywood tape became public. I think Jane and I managed, just barely, to ensure that Ezra was not exposed to that moment of obscene white male privilege. Trump was graphic. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. In the spirit of locker room jocularity, the Access Hollywood host, Billy Bush, was quick to express wonder and amazement. Bush, whatever you want. Trump, grab him by the pussy. You can do anything. Jane and I tried, as far as it was possible, to spare Ezra these lurid details. At the very least, the more than usually crude ones. Ezra has linguistic facility enough. No need to fine-tune it. And now, at the time of this writing, he is possessed of a pre-adolescent imagination. This means an extended vocabulary and an aptitude for just the right turn of phrase. At the age of 8, he certainly did not need to be introduced to the language of the grab-em-by-the-pussy variety. No matter, Ezra, like many of the kids at his school, where Trump was, and remains, viscerally disliked. clearly grasped the gist. In the age of the internet, it has become impossible, for good as well as ill, to shield one's child from a presidential candidate's and then a president's boorishness and vulgarity. In any case, since Ezra has, as just mentioned, his own iPad, supplemented since 2019 by a smartphone, which he wields with a disconcerting proficiency, he can lay eyes on all the information his heart desires. Worst of all, Ezra is far more adept than I am at finding his way around internet sites such as YouTube and TikTok, and who knows what else. Ezra can access sites that recount Trump's latest transgressions with no difficulty at all. It is all readily available, everything from stories about Trump's alleged assaults on women to his early morning unfiltered tweets, id of the purest variety, Freud might say. All of this is exacerbated by Trump's standing as a septuagenarian who boasts the world's shortest attention span. One wonders if Freud might be able to explain how, not if, the two are linked. To say nothing of Trump's mindless rants and his blatant lies, more than 19,000 and counting as of June 2020, to say nothing of his blatant racism. For Ezra, it is the last propensity that disturbs the most. This all came to a head in the most personal way in the spring and summer of 2020. The ways in which violence against black bodies unsettles Ezra was brought home as a visceral truth in the period following the murder of George Floyd, an African-American man, by a white Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, as three of Chauvin's colleagues looked on. Officers Thomas Lane, J. Alexander King, and Toe Tao watched as Chauvin kept his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 49 seconds. While we live in Ithaca, New York, Ezra's two older brothers live in Minnesota. Alex, the oldest, lives in St. Paul, and Anton, as well as members of our extended family, lives in Minneapolis, and not just any neighborhood, but in the Longfellow neighborhood in South Minneapolis. Anton lives literally just a few blocks from East 38th Street and Chicago, which is in the adjoining Powderhorn neighborhood where Floyd's murder took place. Not our neighborhood as such, but our home away from home. So, yes, in an expansive, proprietary sense, our neighborhood. Every year, we spend at least a couple of weeks of our summer vacation in the Longfellow neighborhood. We shop at the Target, just this side, our side, of the railway tracks that separate Longfellow from Powderhorn. That was ransacked and left a burned-out shell. It has since been rebuilt into an upscale store, more Whole Foods than Target, if you can believe that. We ride our bikes down Lake Street, past the police station that was gutted by the protesters, in order to enter the Greenway, a pleasant, winding bike path that leads to downtown Minneapolis. The corner of Minnehaha Avenue and Lake Street is home to the 3rd Precinct, which, as we are, by now, all too aware, is arguably the worst police precinct in all of Minneapolis. We patronize the local bowling alley, Memory Lanes. We order takeout from our favorite Indian restaurant, Gandhi Mahal, also, sadly, a victim of the protests and gone for good. From time to time, Ezra, Anton, and I check out the fancy bikes at the store called The Hub, which has all the trappings of a hipster joint. On May 25th, Memorial Day, 2020, from our home in Ithaca, we watched the video. Derek Chauvin's knee on George Floyd's neck until Floyd died. We watched it. Replay after replay. Endlessly. We watched in horror, understanding the anger of the protests that followed Floyd's killing. Nevertheless, we were still aghast as our part of the country erupted into flames. Death, black death, police brutality, destruction, looting, carnage, anger. Our response, Ezra's, Jane's, and mine, was visceral. It could not but be. We know this neighborhood. Our family lives there. We live part of our ordinary lives there. There is for us a geopolitical intimacy with, an effective bond with, the ways in which the Black Lives Matter movement achieved a new national intensity, as well as an international resonance, and the Defund the Police movement found its first voice. We have walked these South Minneapolis streets. We will walk these Longfellow and Powderhorn streets again. As a diasporic Black man who is father to a Black son, to watch the George Floyd-derived spectacle unfold in South Minneapolis is to know terror as a dull, immediate fear. This is how terror induces helplessness. This is how, in destroying a life, lives, terror threatens to vacate psychic intimacy, how it can throw one's place in the world into question. In our Ithaca living room, huddled together, out of an unspeakable vulnerability, the three of us watched Dave Chappelle's Netflix special titled 8:46. 8 minutes and 46 seconds was the originally reported duration of Chauvin's kneeling on George Floyd's neck. The time to death is everything. Because of time, what else could Chappelle's special have been named? Alex sent us the link to 8:46. And so, Jane, Ezra, and I watched Chappelle. A key figure in this essay, Chappelle held forth on interalia, police brutality. We watched in desperate, disenfranchised silence. We watched it again and again. We watched 8:46 because Chappelle understands. What is more, Chappelle understands, in a critical, Heideggerian sense, that is, Chappelle's, too, understand encompasses both Verstehen, to make something stand in the open, and Verstand, which signifies reason, or reason, what we take to be common sense, or a general understanding of what is, or should be, obvious to all. Again, we could peg this in some ways at our own peril as common sense. As such, Chappelle departs from Heidegger because the latter insists on a strict separation of one definition from the other. So much that Heidegger dismisses the second definition as not philosophically useful. Chappelle conflates these renderings. More than that, however, he utilizes both in order to mobilize Verstehen and Verstand's different but, for his purposes, mutually reinforcing meanings. For Chappelle, understand equals Verstehen plus Verstand. For Kant, as we know, the distinction is clearer. Kant offers Verstand as understanding and Vernunft as reason. In order to achieve distinction, in the course of which we are doing violence to Heidegger's concept, if not clarify, let us name it Verstehen. Chappelle integrates Verstein and Verstan into a Heideggerian compound so that he can bring to light what it means to understand the black community's response, or the responses of various constituencies within the black community, to George Floyd's murder. Chappelle starts from the premise that to understand is to know what is self-evident, apparent, and commonsensical. Things are as we see them. They are as they appear to us. And because of this, everyone should be able to grasp how it is, how it belongs, that is, to reason. That is, things are as they appear, and, as a consequence, how we process what appears produces, out of its constitutive logic, a reasonable conclusion. Chappelle also relies on Heidegger's Verstein in order, over the course of 8 minutes and 46 seconds, to lay things bare. Chappelle grapples towards the truth of what is by seeking to bring the violence to which black life is subject out into the open, producing a clear grasp of the thing as a whole. Through Verstein, Chappelle mediates his way. 8:46 is nothing less than a thinking of racism, a thinking that emerges out of the urgency of the now, an intense reflection on what is in the United States. As such, 8:46 is a Chappelle special, sui generis, only superficially like his other work, to the more rigorous realm that he crafts as Verstein, so that the former adds critical ballast to the latter, rather than, as in Heidegger's distinction, hierarchizing and, in doing so, refusing Verstein as a mode of critique. These streets will speak for themselves. 1. Approach the matter analogically. It is all quite simple, really. I promise. In order to understand what is happening to and in America in the wake of the death of George Floyd, white America must consider things analogically. The thing that is black America's response to the murder of a black man in broad daylight, a police officer committing this act of violence in full view of his colleagues, indifferent to the onlookers recording him on their cell phones. Some of the bystanders employed Chauvin to stop, to treat Floyd's black life as though it had value, some value, just enough value that would allow Floyd to keep breathing, to treat the other as though he were human. Instead, as a senior officer, Chauvin exercised his authority to the point of death. Chauvin's was an act so blatant in its disregard that it rises to the charge of sadism. Unmoved by all around him, most of all, the dying man beneath his knee, Chauvin committed an act of cruelty as though it were a matter of no consequence. Took a human life as though it were simply another act performed in the line of a duty rooted in violent indifference to black life and death. The route to white Verstein runs through white police sadism. As such, to watch George Floyd being killed is to recoil because of the intense fear and anxiety that it provokes. The work of terror is to make imminent the fragility of black life, always subject to the predations of white force. Black life can be snuffed out at will. Black life depends on the forbearance of white force. And should we have any difficulty understanding the propensity for white police sadism, all we need to do is turn to Chappelle. He just happens to have the perfect analogy. If white America wants to understand black America and its response to George Floyd's killing by a white policeman on a Minneapolis street, all white America has to do is think like the Los Angeles Police Department. There is, of course, another alternative. White America could think a mimesis of the self. That is, it could seek to comprehend those individuals, those constituencies of white America, who are publicly supportive of the black struggle against injustice, those white Americans who participate in protests, those white Americans who lead movements in areas where there are no significant black populations. In the summer of 2020, white people in the city of Portland, Oregon, the state of Utah, and other venues showed themselves ready to struggle for the transcendent principle, which we could name justice, equality, or simply the determination to make their voices heard for what might be called, commonsensically, doing the right thing. Self-reflection, on the order of the white self addressing its intellectually delinquent, morally abject white self. Why do other whites have the capacity for verstand? Is there something to be learned not from those Americans who are unlike me, but from those whom I resemble in racial profile, if not in the ability to understand? To be specific, all white America has to do is emulate the mindset of the 400 members of the LAPD who hunted down and killed Christopher Dorner, a black man who had previously worn the uniform of the LAPD. Dorner was born in New York City and raised in Southern California. From 2002 to 2013, he served as an officer in the U.S. Navy Reserve. In 2007, he joined the LAPD, a short-lived tenure. He was fired from the LAPD in 2008, in Dorner's view, an act of retaliation for his having filed a complaint about a fellow cop, Teresa Evans, for using excessive force while arresting a suspect suffering from dementia and schizophrenia. From the time of his dismissal in 2008 through 2011, Dorner appealed his firing to various institutions, beginning with the LAPD and going all the way up to the Superior Courts and California Appellate Courts. None of it met with any success, finding himself out of options. In February 2013, Dorner posted his manifesto as the document became known to his Facebook page. In his manifesto, Dorner named 40 police officers he intended to kill. He alleged that the LAPD remained, despite the turmoil of the 1992 riots, intensely racist, and that the department had not changed at all since the Rampart and Rodney King days. From February 3rd to February 12th, Dorner killed 4 people. His victims were 2 police officers, a young woman named Monica Kwan, and her fiancé, Keith Lawrence, who was African-American. Monica Kwan was the daughter of Randall Kwan, the attorney who represented Dorner in his lawsuit against the LAPD. According to Dorner, Randall Kwan, who had been the first Asian-American captain in the LAPD, was sympathetic to the department and so had not provided the kind of counsel his case required. The LAPD tracked Dorner to a cabin in the San Bernardino Mountains near Big Bear Lake. The police surrounded the cabin, and after Dorner failed to comply with their demand to surrender, law enforcement bulldozed the building and fired pyrotechnic tear gas canisters into it. According to the coroner's account, Dorner died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. Chappelle, whom Dorner names a genius in his manifesto, has a different account of Dorner's demise. Dorner affords comedian Kevin Hart the genius honor as well, much to Chappelle's chagrin. It is, however, chagrin of the most endearing variety. Chappelle starts 8:46 slowly, relating the events of Dorner's death. For the most part, he maintains, for the length of the scene, a staccato style, with short, punctuated bursts of speech, culminating in an emphatic eruption. By the end of the Dorner scene, Chappelle is literally spitting out his words. They found him, Big Bear, hiding in a cabin. When they found out what this nigger was, no less than 400 police officers showed up to answer the call. And boy, let me tell you something. They Swiss cheese this nigger. He is dead as dead can be. And you know why 400 cops showed up? Because one of their own was murdered. So, how the fuck can't they understand what's going on in these streets? We saw ourselves like you see yourself. To make sense of the protests that shook the nation after May 25th, 2020, requires nothing other than a basic grasp of mimicry. Call it empathy, if you insist, or not, as you wish. Verstand would do as well. Just practice the political act of feeling like. A feeling like Black America. A feeling like, if not someone other than you, then some white person, or a collection of white persons, LAPD officers intent on avenging their own. Who is not you, but whose outlook Chappelle presumes you to share? Chappelle asks white America to see itself as another, heavily armed version of itself, to imagine itself as an LAPD officer who had lost a colleague to a dismissed and, needless to say, bitter former colleague. Chappelle asks white America to imagine that, just for a moment. We can all agree, this is simple, and not in the least bit difficult thing to do. If white America can transcend itself for a moment, then Chappelle's analogy will be crystal clear. The protests that followed George Floyd's death were, if the turn of phrase might be permitted, no different from the response of 400 LAPD cops showing up outside a cabin in Big Bear. How could white America not understand? Chappelle's analogy is disproportionately biblical in its simplicity, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Except that on this occasion, that single tooth, Dorner, had to endure a force, LAPD officers, 400 times larger. Except that the entire history of whites in America is one of disproportionate force. But let us not lose sight of Chappelle's analogy, because what happened on the streets of Minneapolis, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, placid suburbs in Utah, and struggling post-industrial towns in central Pennsylvania in response to George Floyd's killing is the racially inverted image of what took place in the San Bernardino Mountains. Chappelle enjoins white America to try to draw from the same psychic well, to summon up from somewhere in the entanglements of its white self the depths of LAPD anger. Chappelle asks white America to tap into its considerable reservoir of racial resentment. Make the effort. Chappelle urges white America to recall those fierce feelings of loyalty to one of its own. Having commanded that response, or those responses, white America now has to think itself in relation to the indigenous population. Not only were the colonists armed with superior weaponry, but they were also not adverse to low-tech but deadly biological warfare, such the distribution of blankets contaminated with smallpox, and in relation to the enslaved Africans and their descendants. Again, guns, whips, all forms of corporal punishment, as Uncle Tom's Cabin, the blues, jazz, and roots, from their different vantage points, remind us. A pattern that continued through Reconstruction, that marked the battles for civil rights, Bull Connor is but the most embolic figure in this regard, snarling dogs, protesters, the late John Lewis included, marching fearful but undaunted across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and continues into our moment. The story of America for its Black population, the reality for minorities in this country, is one reign of terror after another, with nary a Robespierre in sight.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?